Hey friends, Ayana here. It is a crisp new season, and we are so excited to bring you a brand new series, In the Company of Humpbacks. Over three episodes, we'll wander the waters off Alaska, exploring the lives, the thrums, and the migrations of humpback whales, with stories and insight from Fred Sharp, Rachel Mead, and Joe Olson. This series is full of sonic exploration, migration stories, and research discoveries. But it's also about something deeper, curiosity, wonder, and the relationships we build with the more than human world. Along the way, we move between science and story, the technical and the magical, between whale thrums and the questions we carry. This journey came to life thanks to the generosity and care of the Five Fingers Lighthouse and the Alaska Whale Foundation. You can learn more about their work at forthewild.world. Now, episode one begins with a simple impulse, the desire to understand. For all you whale geeks and sound nerds out there, this is your episode. Joe Olson and Fred Sharp guide us deep into the technical world of humpback thrums and aerial whale sounds. They give us the vocabulary and the listening tools that'll carry us through the rest of the series. Along the way, we explore questions like, what is whale communication? And how do these thrums travel across the ocean? And what might careful listening teach us about connection with the more than human world? Think of this episode as your entry point into the sonic exploration at the heart of the series.
No doubt an exciting time, and there are tools at our disposal right now that we couldn't have dreamed of even a few years ago, so I think the future is bright.
We're listening. I think we're hearing some...
A little gurgle, a little whinny call, and you texted the file. Let's have a look. Okay. So we'll try listening again, see what we got. Did you get any low frequency?
It's very low, bassy. Like,
yeah, yes, it is. Yep, exactly.
Yeah, tell us about this sound that we just heard. This low bass, kind of groan almost.
So this was in the evening. Things were getting dark, and we couldn't really see the whales, but it was a beautiful evening, and they sort of come and press around the island after the sun goes down. They are something about the prey environment where they start to become a little bit more structure and pinnacle and reef associated, and so it's really cool. We can just hear individual whales out there, even though we can't see them, because these thrums appear to have individual nuances to them. We can sort of track this, how this one, as it's either being pushed by the flood tide or the whale's asleep or it's actively pursuing prey. We don't often know the behavioral context, but there's something about the nightfall that gets these whales going with these low frequency, near infrasound. And it took us quite a while of listening and peering. And then we needed Joe's extra sharp ear. So Joe, tell us how you track these underwater component down.
Yeah, well, and it actually wasn't my ear, it was my eye that was able to find it, because it's easy to hear, like Fred was saying, it's really easy to hear the sounds in air. And if you look at this image that I'm sharing with you, and you don't need to really understand what a spectrogram is and all the details of it.
It's like a musical score, isn't it, basically?
In a way, but what the important thing, though, is that you're looking at the sound pitch, the frequency, and it gets higher as you go up on the screen. And just like music, right? So, in fact, this bottom image almost looks like it could be the lines on sheet music. And those are just the different harmonics that the whale's producing. And so as time goes on, it goes from left to right. It's just time moving and then the frequency changing up and down. And the color tells you how strong it is. And this is just a relative measure. So it's not an absolute. We don't know really how loud it is, but it's just relative to everything else. So you can see on the air one, it's mostly black around these lines, meaning that what is not the sound that we're interested in is really quiet, but the sound itself is really loud relative to that. If you look at the underwater one, you notice that there's all this light blue and colors all around, and that the line that we're interested in, which is just above the one on the screen below, or the window below in the air, is just a faint green. So on this scale, it means that there's very little difference between the sound we're interested in and all the other sounds that are being produced in the water. So it's really difficult to identify these sounds because it's hard to hear when you've got a sound that's just barely louder than everything else that's around. And so what we were looking for is this shape of the sound in air. And then I started scrolling through the sounds in the water to see if I could find anything that looked similar at roughly the same time. And this is an example when we found one. And the water one showed up earlier than the one in the air. And that's what we expect, because the speed of sound in water is much faster than the speed of sound in air. It's about 4.5 times faster. But if I click on this, at the beginning of the beginning of the water sound, okay, and then I move over to where the air sound starts, you can see that's approximately 1.2 seconds. So the sound in water reached the hydrophone 1.2 seconds faster than the sound in air. And the thing that I got excited about is that means we can calculate roughly how far away the whale is without even seeing it, with just using a hydrophone and a microphone.
What do you think the whale is saying? Like, and how do you differentiate a sound like this from other sounds so that you can categorize it or even begin to, I guess?
Yeah, great question. And, you know, when we first started detecting these, it's really intuitively pleasing to think about that these are a form of communication. And, you know, humpback whales are extremely verbose underwater with their social chatter and their songs and when they're screaming at the herring to chase them up to the surface. And so when we hear these coming through the air, we're already really inured to thinking that these are very communicative species, and this has got to be some crazy, more, you know, perhaps some sort of long range rumble. I've found some food over here, or we've got some medicine killer whales, keep your distance, or we got some medicine killer whales, get over here, need your assistance. But, you know, so when you assume communication, it presupposes there's just certain predictions, there's certain corollaries of communication. If a signal is being used for animals to talk, well, then you expect there to be kind of a conversation of a back and forth. You know, a volley of like, hey, what's going on? Okay, I'm doing okay. So that's the first thing. You also would expect sounds to be able to be detected. You know, you have a very specific sender and a very specific receiver. The sender is usually trying to bend the receiver to its will so that they can get through the day or get what they need. And oftentimes it's a cooperative venture, so it's a win-win situation. But you do expect, not only do you expect there to be a call and response, but you expect to see some behavioral change. Come on over here, or dive down to 60 feet now. That's where the krill layer is most abundant. Or if it's a mom calf solicitation cry, you expect those two to get closer together. And then once the mom and the calf are together, then that call falls away because they've achieved their goal. And so with communication, we expect we also expect it to be really detectable by this receiver and the sender. Right now, there's no known mechanism for a mysticete whale, a baleen whale, and with the humpback belongs to be able to detect sound that's moving through the air. Doesn't mean they're not doing it, but we just don't have any. I mean, is there sound receptors on the blowhole? I mean, what's going to be above the water? We know that the air-water interface, the surface of the ocean, it's almost like a perfect mirror in terms of just a very small fraction of the sound can get through that air-water interface, because water is 800 times denser than air. Sound wants to stay underwater and it bounces back. And then with the air sounds, they have a really hard time getting into the water. And so, when we just couldn't find these, the underwater component, until Joe had his expert eyes. Like, oh, we are picking up a little bit of ghosting there. It's something is being produced. So if it was communication, and if especially for long range communication, the signal should be strong. You know, it should have some power. It should be able to transmit through wave slap and snapping shrimp and even vessel noise. And so we're just not seeing that. So that kind of militates against the notion of communication. And also the fact that they just appear to originate from these animals kind of randomly. You know, their breathing is sort of a random thing, and the thrums are produced by a raspberry type puckering of the blowhole. And that is associated with a breathing cycle, and breathing is something that animals can do. It's certainly under conscious control, and certainly cetaceans, but oftentimes it's your breathing is responding to your socializing or your pursuit of prey, and then you're down below and you're swimming around and blowing bubble nets and lunging and engulfing, and then got to go back to the surface to breathe. And so you're going up to breathe, and then you have these potentially incidental sounds produced during breathing. And so once you get a bunch of animals out pursuing prey independently, they're kind of random to each other. And we don't hear these sounds clustering in time and space suggestive of communication. And then we did our darn tootin' best to peer into the below the human hearing level by playing with various satellite dishes and various parabolics, converting them to concentrate more sound energy on the microphone so we could see if there was an infrasonic component. And they haven't found that either. And science often works by not being able to definitively show that something is true, but that you've been able to show that your other ideas about moth and mom calf pairs, well, everybody seems to be doing this, so it's not just mom and calf, so probably not that. And so you start eliminating notions until last individual standing, last one standing. And so some sort of maintenance activity, as we reflected on earlier. And Joe, what are your thoughts?
Well, and I'm not the biologist, but I do think that it could still be indicative of emotional state. That it's not just, they're not just randomly breathing and sometimes getting this sound, but it could be like Fred, you and I had, and others had just talked about, well, it could be just having that feeling of just, you've had a lot of activity and now you're just relaxing. And when your body relaxes, all your little, your muscles and your lips and everything get a little bit more relaxed. And so when you breathe out, you just make that raspberry sound. So it could be indicative of that.
Interesting. Yes. Yeah, so kind of a groan of satiation or contentment. I kind of get that feeling. I mean, it certainly sounds like it. The other evening when we were reflecting with the residents of Petersburg who live out Sandy Beach Road overlooking Frederick Sound. And that was the kind of general consensus that doesn't sound at all aggressive. It sounds like, something was just accomplished, and like a sigh of contentment on the other hand, it's like, we know that adaptive sounds for maintenance in other contexts, like with the African hunting dogs that sneeze for maintenance of the airway and the sinuses, but they also sneeze as a communication to, get their group mates roused for the hunt. And so we just may not have yet sampled the behavioral context where these potentially maintenance sounds or background sounds are pressed into service for communication. So there's still lots we have to learn, but our initial feedback suggests we don't know what the hell's going on.
Can we hear another sound?
So here's a nice, strong one that, is pretty bold. And it's cool. I mean, in support of a potential communication function is that not all thrums are created equal. We're finding quite a bit of variation, and we don't know to what degree that represents individual variation, consistent, very identifiable variation, or does that represent just changing emotional states? But some of these are pretty intense. So we're going to listen to this strong thrum right header. And some of them are longer in duration than others. Nice little powerful one there. It had a bit of an inflection, kind of a brrr, like it was, like sometimes the animals are maybe a little uncertain when they produce it, or maybe there's a, sometimes it'll be paired or it'll come in multiple chunks, like brrr. Sometimes it feels kind of forced, like brrr. So these all could be tied to different interior emotional states of the animal. Or if it's a maintenance thing, like they're backwashing their baleen, it could be, whereas it's just representing utilitarian back pressure, how it's how water jet is being pushed on, or the tongue is being pushed onto the baleen, but you know, we've got, you know, what, 50 million years of separation with these beings. You know, they went back into the ocean and we stayed on land, and so this could be something that we haven't even thought of yet, you know, some sort of a maintenance or interior thing, or triggered to some emotions that we may have once had and then evolutionary got winnowed out, or something will evolve one day, or something we'll only be able to surmise. But that's why we love working with humpbacks, because they're always two steps ahead and keeping you guessing.
I want to pause for a second and share a little behind the scenes story. So Fred and I have known each other for years now, and we always run into each other on Chichikov Island in Southeast Alaska, where his field office is. And every time I see him, he brings the biggest smile to my face, and I usually a little giggle because of his very Dr. Seuss-like spirit. Same place, different year, and the conversations just keep getting longer, which I am so appreciative of. Now, this summer, we ran into each other again, picking blueberries on this little boardwalk trail, and we just stayed there for hours, talking about whales and politics, AI, the oceans, Alaska life, and everything kind of tangled together. It felt really easy, like, oh yeah, we are kin. And a few months later, I'm at my neighbor's house picking cherries, totally in it, hands full, not stopping, and Fred calls. He's got Joe on speaker, and they're like, you have to come to Five Fingers Lighthouse. And I'm thinking, okay, that sounds amazing, and also kind of insane. Like, tiny island, very, very remote, cliffs, storms, my toddler in tow, boats, tides, timing, no helicopter, just so many logistics. And still, I said yes, because this is honestly why I do this work. I love saying yes to wild invitations, to people who are deeply in relationship with place, to stories that come from the land and water and the more than human world. And I guess that's what I want to name here. For the Wild is shifting. We're becoming a studio now, partnering with people and groups who want help telling their stories. If you're holding a place or a project or a campaign, and you're feeling like this needs to be told, well, that's something we do. We only take a few projects each year, but if you feel called to reach out, to invite us in, we'd love to hear from you. Email us at connect@forthewild.world. Okay, back to the conversation.
I really liked when we were at Five Fingers and you talked about why, or whale language at all, is not just for our interest. Of course, there's beauty to that, but when it's reciprocal, when it's like, okay, hey, whales, we want to learn about your language because we want to be in right relationship with you. And the more that we learn about you, the more that we can show up, the more that we can learn about each other, we know how to be together. So I really appreciated hearing about how learning about the whale language can actually act as a reciprocal relationship practice.
Absolutely. Yeah, we just knowing that they have some structures or a little higher order communication system, since, you know, we're one of the ultimate communicating species. And so we feel a little more akin to them. And obviously, if we could, you know, get a better appreciation of the meaning and function of these sounds, we might be able to ask them where it hurts and they could tell us. Mm-hmm. And by understanding which sounds are the most used, the most frequently found in their lexicon, and, you know, the more common sounds, and we're talking more specifically now about their underwater vocals, you know, those that are used more frequently, we assume are of greater importance. And so we look at those frequently used sounds, and we ask, are these ones being masked by anthropogenic noise, by ship noise? And so it's potential that critical sounds like a solicitation for help, or an alarm call associated with predators, or a bonanza food patch, are we masking those and making it harder for animals to, across the summer months, to just continuously degrading their ability to communicate and feed? And so they're leaving to Hawaii with reduced body weight and fuel storage. It's all entirely speculation, but you get the point that there's lots that we, in ways we can gain insight into their lives and needs by understanding their communication system.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Is there another sound that you could play us?
Let's find another fun one. Some of them are really low in frequency. Let's have a little listen here.
Hmm.
Yeah, it's cool.
So vibrational.
Yeah. Still, you know, you always have that. And I still, even at kilometers away, you're still picking up those flapping nares, right? Mm. Those, like, I don't like to call them raspberries or Bronx cheers. Mm. How about nareberries? So, Joe, let's pop over and take a...
It's like an instrument, really.
Yes, it is. It's almost like one of those droning instruments, or like a bagpipe, or some... Some sort of reed instrument,
right.
Instrument. Joe, do you want to pop over to the... to figure one, and we can look at some of the spectrograms on these.
That's cool. That was great. Yeah. Almost like that was like a purr.
Yeah.
It's beautiful. It is. When I listen back to the recordings with both the water and the thrums, it's very soothing to me. I don't know if they feel soothed by the sound of their own voice, but it's, whatever frequencies they're giving off, it's really, it is, it's like meditative, or it's something, it's very regulating to the nervous system.
It's almost Gregorian in its, and because it's perched up in our hearing range, we know we can grapple with it, and we can, unlike, you know, apparently some sounds below human hearing into the subsonic or the infrasonic range, those I understand can actually be kind of annoying and set anxiety. Whereas these low frequency, they're almost like Gregorian chants more, or some sort of like deep Northumbrian hornpipe or something. And the benefit of that is they travel for miles. It'd be really interesting to actually get some of these very deep thrums with a really good speaker and then play those underwater as part of the playback experiments to see how, if the whales respond to picking up on this infrasound underwater.
Well, I'm curious, when you are doing playbacks, or when people are doing playbacks, why are they doing these playbacks? What are they learning? I don't love the notion of trying to, quote, outsmart the whales or trick the whales into thinking that we are them to get information from them. I mean, I know I'm really humanizing this discussion in that way. But I just want to bring that up. Like, what is the goal usually? Or maybe there's multiple goals I'm imagining for playback. And how do you do it ethically? And if you want to breach the AI conversation about that, I'm curious.
Well, first of all, you were at the lighthouse and you heard what happens when a vessel goes by. First of all, we are absolutely bombarding these animals with mechanical noise and drivetrains and singing propellers and under sonar and seismic exploration. So we are sending a lot of sound onto their hearing apparatus, their tympanas. And we do that unconsciously most of the time and abusively and unthinkingly. And so if it does mean in the pursuit of knowledge of how we can be better conservationists and share the oceans with them and get some appreciation for our sounds and our functions of our sound, yes, it may at times result in some small experiments where we play back some sounds and the whale's like, what's that? And they come over and we play back a sound of an old friend and they come over and yes, we expect there to be some expectancy violation and the animal's being initially confused. And so we did one experiment, this was in 2019 with my colleagues on the Whale SETI team. We did a playback to an individual, a known whale called Twain, and the whale came over to the boat and was initially like, you could just tell by its demeanor, like it almost just kind of froze for a few moments. And then it gave a couple of little kind of a kind of that wheezy blow indicating some measure of excitement or disturbance or arousal, non-sexual arousal, which is like, what? And then, but then it kind of settled in, kind of relaxed and was like, okay, these are people. And I was like, okay, well, what's going on? Like, and so it hung out for 20 minutes with us and we just bounced the same sound back and forth and we could change the interval that the animal, like if we only waited 10 seconds, the animal would wait 10 seconds. We waited a minute, it would wait a minute. So it was like, clearly there was some ability to perceive each other. And, but that's just the nature of a lot of playback experiments is that you observe the sound in the wild that the animals make and you get a nice library of their sounds. You look at the behavioral context that the sounds are produced in to infer potential function. As we've discussed a bunch, mom, infant, separation cries or come here or get out of here or, and so by quote unquote tricking the animal to thinking that you are one of their own species, a conspecific, you want to test ideas about the sound. And, if in fact it is an assembly cry, if it is an assembly call that they're making, we could actually coax animals over to us with this sound. That has huge conservation value. I think of animals get stuck in marinas and up rivers or are in shallows and trying to navigate their way out or are caught in a lagoon during a lower tidal cycle. It's like, if these sounds are associated with affiliation and approaching each other or some sort of contact call, I mean, that's huge for conservation. So yes, I would say in the short term, if we confuse a couple animals, but what it can tell us about conservation tools and also, again, a deeper appreciation that they do have structure and a diversity of meaning to their sounds. And that makes us appreciate them even more, obviously. And so I think the conservation benefits way outweigh the not being able to ask for their permission. I mean, it's kind of like it's the difference between doing an experiment on an animal as opposed to with an animal. Mm-hmm. And I feel like, there's room for that too. So we have two basic types of playbacks. The ones we just described where you want them to think you're one of their own kind to see how they respond to the call. But then there's the one like we had with Twain where the whale hung around long enough that clearly knew it was interacting with people. And so we kind of like to get out, before we start the ones where we're trying to do these dynamic playbacks where it's like, yes, we're definitely people. We would be very interested in communicating with you to try to see if we can build on a basic communication system and get you interested and hopefully enjoying this and maybe even getting to the points where you come over and initiate. And that's the fun of doing playbacks, this research from an island environment, because it's a physical, it has spatial, and we do it every year at the same time, late summer, temporal consistency where willing individuals could come and find us again and we can build on our previous dialogues. Mm. So yeah, I think they're robust animals. They're clever animals. I mean, in the face of incredible human, obviously global whaling and their depletion and ship strikes and noise and entanglement and pollutants and ocean acidification and competing for food resources and indigestion of plastics. Despite all that, the humpbacks are, they've surged back, kind of the 14 global distinct population segments are considered weird. And so it's like, they're a pretty robust species. I think we need to give them a little credit that mm-hmm. our little punny little playbacks experiments, relative to what humanity gives them, I think, is somewhat, I think we're giving them a gift and an opportunity for them to hopefully one day tell their story and how we can do right by them. Mm. No doubt an exciting time, and there are tools at our disposal right now that we couldn't have dreamed of even a few years ago. So I think the future is bright. Mm. And hopefully what we hope we will learn things that we, again, we can be better ocean stewards.
Yeah. That's Freddie. That's really like refreshing.
All right, friends, that's where we'll leave things for today. Projects like In the Company of Humpbacks don't happen alone. They unfold through long conversations, through time on the water, through shared curiosity, and through a whole constellation of people who care deeply about these whales and the places they call home. This series grew alongside research and storytelling connected to the Alaska Whale Foundation and the Five Fingers Lighthouse, along with many other generous folks who shared their time, their knowledge, and their boats with us along the way. It's also the first series we're releasing through a new studio model at For the Wild, something we've been quietly building behind the scenes. A space where partners come to us with the stories they want told, and together, we collaborate on bringing these stories into the world. A big thank you as well to the American Cetacean Society, Barnacle Foods, and the Alaska Fisheries Development Foundation for supporting the work that made this series possible. And of course, to you. Thanks for listening. Thanks for wandering these waters with us. And thanks for being a part of this beautiful listening community we're building together. I'll pass things over now to Victoria for a few credits and ways to stay connected.
Thank you for listening to this episode of For the Wild series, In the Company of Humpbacks. For the Wild is produced by Ayana Young, Erica Ekram, Julia Jackson, Ori Bittle, and Victoria Pham. This series features music and sound design created by the For the Wild studio. You can also join us on Patreon for access to extended episodes, including the extended version of this very episode, along with uncut conversations and our full archive and publishing library. As For the Wild continues its transformation into the For the Wild studio, we invite you to stay close as we explore new creative offerings, collaborations, and ways of listening together to stay connected. Follow For the Wild on Instagram and subscribe to our newsletter for updates, reflections, and upcoming releases. Thank you for being with us, and as always, thank you for listening.